Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello les légendes, nouvelle hors-série business et organisation d'un tournoi ATP 250 du circuit. Cette semaine, on est à Munich avec Patrick Kühnen, le directeur du BMW Open. Je dois dire que c'est assez incroyable d'enregistrer ces hors-séries parce qu'aller à la rencontre des directeurs permet non seulement de découvrir des parcours incroyables sur et en dehors du circuit. La plupart ont été joueurs pro, président de Fédé, capitaine de Coupe Davis et j'en passe. On a affaire à des bibles du tennis qui connaissent pour ainsi dire parfaitement leur sujet et sont passionnés comme jamais par ce sport qui nous anime. Patrick revient pour nous sur sa carrière, son amitié et ses 3 titres en Coupe Davis avec la légende Boris Becker. Il nous fait vivre sa plus grosse victoire à Wimbledon contre Jimmy Connors, puis ses 9 ans de capitaine de l'équipe d'Allemagne en Coupe Davis. Et on termine avec son poste actuel de directeur de tournoi. Patrick n'est pas du tout calé sur la partie chiffrée du BMW Open, puisque l'entière gestion en est confiée à une agence. J'irai donc chercher un membre de cette entreprise l'année prochaine pour en savoir plus. L'audio est uniquement en anglais, vous allez pouvoir apprécier mon accent bien français. Et Gaëtan, qui nous aide sur la traduction, vous a mis des sous-titres sur YouTube. Un grand merci à lui. Pensez à récupérer vos formations gratuites en lien si vous voulez savoir ce que la stat dit de votre jeu. Et si vous voulez muscler votre mental avec Jean-Philippe Vaillant qui a coaché 12 top 100, vous avez un second lien. C'est cadeau, c'est pour nous. Abonnez-vous à la chaîne et mettez-nous un commentaire sympa. Ça nous aide comme jamais à faire connaître le contenu et à vous régaler chaque semaine. Voilà, c'est parti les légendes. Bonne découverte du BMW Open de Munich et bonne écoute à tous.
This is from 74.
Nice. You know what? I'm reading it right now.
It's an amazing book.
I'm just starting it.
It's really amazing. Okay, let's do this. Okay. Let's do it.
Nice. Okay, so quick intro about you. We talk about your career as a tennis player, then as a Davis Cup captain, and then tournament director.
All right.
Let's go for it. Patrick, you were born in 1966 in Puttlingen, Germany.
Is that That's a great pronunciation.
Sorry about it.
No,
you've been a professional tennis player from 85 till 96, 43 in the world at your best rank in single. You played quarterfinals at Wimbledon, beating Jimmy Connors in 5th sets battle in the 4th round, 28 in double. Your best result was the same semi-final at Wimbledon. You won 3 titles in double, 2 with Boris Becker as a partner. You won 3 times the Davis Cup. Then you were captain of the German Davis Cup 9 years between 2003 and 2012. You're now the tournament director of the ATP 250 BMW Open in Munich, Germany. The tournament was created in 1900.
Yeah.
It was played without tiebreak until 1971. Then up to 5 sets until 1985. Tennis legends like Tyriac, Stan Smith, Ash, Vilas, Lendl, Agassi, and Federer won the tournament. It's on outdoor clay, perfect way to prepare Roland Garros, even though sometimes it's a bit colder than in Paris. Depends the meteo in Paris. Sometimes it's very cold, sometimes very, very warm. Can we start this interview, Patrick? Can you tell us, well, you started playing tennis at 9. How did you discover this sport? And do you remember what were your first emotions on the court?
Well, thanks for the intro, Max. Yeah, I started with 9. I was playing actually soccer as a young kid. And then I was introduced to tennis through my parents.
Yep.
You know, my parents played and I sometimes went along with my parents. So I hit a few minutes with my dad after he finished his tennis session. And then I spent hours on a concrete wall, playing with the wall and playing against the wall for many, many hours as a young kid.
Yeah.
And I remember by the age of 9, I had like my first lessons. And I had a very cool, a bit older coach around the 60s, but he was very patient. We played some tennis. And, you know, whenever I had enough of tennis, you know, we played some soccer or any other sport. So it's just, you know, game time. And we just had a great time on the court. And, you know, there I discovered my passion for tennis. And I can tell you that when I was a junior, I had kind of a temper, you know.
Okay.
I didn't like losing. So yeah. I sometimes freaked out on the court. But over the time and then later coming onto the ATP tour and the tour, everything, you know, went more into focus and development and, of course, maturity. But I always loved to play tennis from the beginning, and I still love it today. This is my passion today.
Were you picking legend players when you were playing against the wall? Did you imagine that
sure.
someone famous? And who?
Sure.
Are
you? I mean, you know, I was playing. Literally, I was practicing on the wall, and then I remember that I had the idea of playing against the wall. I mean, you know, playing against the wall is like as a kid, you know, with your imagination and everything. And as a young boy, I was watching the Wimbledon finals. I can remember, you know, like Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe, and also Roscoe Tanner, Jimmy Connors, and all those players. So I, you know, not only imagined myself playing against Bjorn Borg or against Jimmy Connors,
yeah.
But even though in the junior, I remember when I was 12 and I was playing the regional championships, you know, the new shirt of McEnroe just came out prior to the tournament I played.
Okay.
And back then it was a Sergio Tacchini shirt, you know, with the stripes across the chest, so to say. And I went to my mother and said, look, I need this shirt. Can you really get me this shirt? I'm crazy for this shirt, you know. And then I literally put on that shirt.
Yeah.
In the first round, my mother had to wash it. I put it on the second round. My mother had to wash it. Third round, and I made it to the finals, you know, with that shirt.
Nice.
So I was really superstitious, but, you know, it made me feel like so much better and gave me so much confidence. And, you know, when I was 12, 13 years old, I also copied John McEnroe's serve a little bit, you know, this sideways stand.
Yeah.
And I think we also had back then the same haircut, yeah.
What was your best ranking as a junior?
In Germany, I was not really up there until I played my first semifinals, 83, and I was 17 years old. Prior to that, I was just, you know, circling around the tournaments, but I was never up in the German rankings. And I think even though when I was playing semifinals with 17, I was not one of the top juniors, you know, I went and played some cup for Germany when I was 17, 18, but this was more an exception and I was kind of a late bloomer, I would say.
And you said you played semifinals in a German tournament or in Wimbledon?
Yes, in the German national championships, yes.
Oh, okay. All right. Boris Becker is 1 year younger than you.
That's correct, yeah.
When did you guys meet?
That's kind of a funny story. We, you know, in Germany, when you play the German Junior Championships, you, as a junior, you also have to umpire one match. And I played my first round match. I think I was 16. It was an outdoor championships of the juniors. And Boris was my umpire. And so Boris was literally, I think, 15, I was 16, and he was umpiring my match. And this was literally the first time we've ever met. And he told me years later that, you know, when he came there on the court, you know, and saw me play, he thought, ooh, what a crazy guy this is, you know, like.
Yeah. Amazing.
That was our first meeting, yeah.
And then did you become friends or you were instantly rivals?
No. We became actually close friends. We became very close friends. Literally, when I was 18, I moved to play Bundesliga in Germany for a club in Mannheim. And Boris back then still lived at home, you know, and he was practicing at home. And this started around 83 as well, you know, and those two cities were pretty close to each other, you know, pretty close. So we practiced a lot when I was, you know, in the juniors. And we got to practice more and more. And then later on, you know, we played Davis Cup together. We played doubles together. We had some practice sessions together, some preseason training camps and whatever. And you know, we became close friends and still are today.
Sweet. You said that when you were a young player, it was a hard time for you on court, mental, in the mental side. Was it the main part that made you become a great player? Because you said that you were average player in Germany until 17 years old. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you will tell us, but was it the most important part of your game that improved to make you a great player and actually a top player?
I think, if I think back, you know, I didn't cope well when I was losing, you know. I didn't really, it really got to me when I lost matches. And so in order not to lose, I practiced harder than before, you know. So I invested even more into the game and I trained harder and I worked more. And also I worked on my mental side. And when I switched to Mannheim by the age of 17, 18 and starting to play for the Bundesliga team there, I also met a new coach and he worked with me a little bit differently in terms of intensity and also guided me towards, focusing on the right stuff, how to really channel my energy and to play with a clear mindset, to go on the court every single time with a game plan, you know, and just not go on the court and just like that and see how everything works out. So he worked really hard with me in terms of maturity as a player, you know, not only on the game side and on the tactic side, but also on the mental side and, of course, also on the physics.
Is that the time when you read Inner Game of Tennis, that the books you should...
Look, I was not aware of Inner Game of Tennis when I was a player.
Okay.
So I really, I would say, found out about the Inner Game of Tennis when I was doing Davis Cup captain, when I was Davis Cup captain for Germany. And in my quest as a coach to find my best for my players, you know, I was searching for additional information, for other information, for new information. And that's when I came across Inner Game of Tennis. And I read the book and I literally also met with Sean Brawley, who is kind of the one who is taking the Inner Game of Tennis from Tim Galway further.
Yeah,
he's coaching that way in the States. So I met Sean Brawley and he's, you know, also a coach. And there I had a chance to dive really deep into the Inner Game of Tennis. And I have to say that I'm a great fan of the Inner Game of Tennis. And when I coach today, this is the major part of my coaching.
Sweet. Before you got to play the Grand Slams and all these main tournaments, did you went through Challengers, Satellites? I don't know how it was called.
Oh, yeah.
Back in time.
It was kind of a tough start, yeah.
And can you just tell us how many players were ranked in the ATP ranking? Because back in time, there were way less players.
I know, yes.
How did you make that part? How did you go through that part of your career? The second,
it was really, you know, when I was moving towards professional tennis, it was very different than it is today, because you could hardly ask anybody, you know, how do I do this, you know? And back then I was fortunate because I had an Australian coach in so to say, one of the clubs I played in my home area, you know. He was from Australia there, and he literally knew a little bit about the ATP tour, and he was kind of mentoring me also through that time. And back then, you know, you didn't have futures, you had the satellites. So you had four tournaments plus the Masters. So in the four tournaments, you had to qualify for the Masters. And only once you do the Masters, you can make ATP points. So back then, you know, we were like, you know, some German guys getting together and traveling to play some tournaments. And it was really tough, because if you think back, you know, I remember like a trip I made to Spain. And back then, you know, you didn't even have mobile phones, and back then you had to go to phone cell, you know, to a phone booth in order to call home. So
a cabine.
A cabine, yes. You know, I had some cash, you know, some coins. And once a week, I was like 16, 17, yeah, once a week, I called home, you know. So let's say you lose first round. And once a week, you call home, but you cannot talk too long because it's back then it was really expensive, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, when you start, you don't have much money. So it was kind of tough, you know. You had to really come through by yourself and also, you know, being together with your friends, with your colleagues and stuff like that. So it was kind of a family circuit traveling to those satellite tournaments. And we kind of helped each other out the best way we could. And it was quite tough, I have to say, back then, to get my first ATP points and to make a kind of a ranking in order to get to the qualifying of other tournaments. And, you know, sometimes I drove to bigger tournaments and I didn't get into qualifying and I drove right back home, you know, because I didn't have a chance to play due to my ranking. But the start was kind of tough. Yeah, it was really tough.
And with what money were you traveling, and were you traveling on your own?
I was looking not to travel on my own, because I was always looking to travel with somebody or maybe with another player, and we could maybe share a coach, or we would help each other out the best way we can. And money-wise, I literally made my first money when I was 17, 18, and I played some Bundesliga tennis.
Yeah.
So I took that money. It was not much because I was really one of the lower ranked players in regards of the team. But I took all of that money and kind of invested that money into my tennis, you know, like for coaching, for stringing, for traveling. And the other part came a bit from my parents.
Yeah.
And, you know, a bit here and a bit there, a bit of prize money. So you had to really throw everything into kind of into the plate. And invest that money. But I always saw it as an investment in myself, you know, in my career, in my quest to become a good player. And this is how I started.
Un court instant de promo pour vous rappeler de vous abonner à la chaîne, de récupérer vos formations gratuites en lien dans la description pour progresser dans votre jeu grâce à la stat. Et la seconde pour muscler votre mental. Mettez-nous un petit like, ça nous fait plaisir. Allez, c'est parti, on y retourne. Do you remember one anecdote, one epic story on the circuit, you lost your racket, so you missed a couple flights, or you were in the wrong city for another tournament.
Sure. How much time you have?
all the time we need for that kind of story. We love
sure,
it.
Sure. Look, it's I was 19. I think it was 19, or maybe I was. I think it was 19. I flew to a tournament, a challenger in Helsinki.
Okay.
My luggage didn't arrive. I only had my, you know, my 3-4 rackets. All the luggage was gone, was lost.
Because you took the racket in the...
Yeah, hand luggage, yeah, in the hand cabin, yes, into the plane. Yeah, so the luggage was gone. So I literally, you know, asked another German guy, and he borrowed me like, you know, one or two shorts, some t-shirts, and the rest, I went to the city and I bought everything I needed, literally, you know.
And was it okay with the sponsor? You didn't have to wear the same?
I didn't have a sponsor back then, so it was all fine, you know, it was all good, you know. But I didn't really have much. I had like two or three shirts, you know, like one or two shorts and you know, stuff you need. So, and I didn't really want to buy much because I was in qualifying, and prior to that tournament, I hardly made it through qualifying. So, you know, I thought like, okay, you know, let's see how this works out. So, you know, I won my first match, second match, third match qualifying. I made it to the main draw. And literally every single evening, you know, I had to wash my stuff in the sink, you know. So every evening I washed everything in the sink. I put it on the heater for next day to be dry and everything. And then I went out next day again, you know, to compete in the qualifying or in the main draw. And I did that for literally 9 days.
Nice.
And I made it all the way to the finals. I literally won the tournament. You
wow.
know? It was crazy. You know, I won the tournament, washing my stuff in the evening and, you know, and putting it on the next day, practicing and matching everything. And I won the tournament. And then I left all the stuff there. I went back home with my rackets and a trophy.
Oh, man, wonderful. What category of tournament was it?
It was a challenger.
Wow, nice.
25 plus age, yeah.
And how come you left the clothes over there since you were winning with them? Maybe you should have played the rest of the season with it, no?
That's literally a good point, yeah. That's a good point, you know. Even though today I would think like, look, it would be nice to have those clothes, yeah. You know, because it's a nice story. But back then, you know, they were just wrecked, you know, after 9 days, me washing everything in the sink. And then I thought like, look, you know.
Yeah.
My stuff didn't come and this stuff, you know, it was literally kind of a help out. But I'm with you, totally with you. And it would be cool to pull that up and show it.
Could you tell us your biggest win on the tour? Maybe make us travel a little bit, do the movie of this particular match. I don't know. I have a guess. I have a clue. I think which one it is. Maybe the one in Wimbledon, but maybe not. Just can you please tell us?
Literally, biggest win was 1988 at Wimbledon against Jimmy Connors on this court number 2, which was back then the graveyard. And gave me a little bit of a confidence boost when I saw the schedule that I was, going against Jimmy Connors on court 2. It turned out well, you know, winning at 5 sets. It was great and you know, unforgettable for me.
And Connors was famous to be very tough mentally, to try to disturb the players, the opponents. Was it the case for that match? Can you make us feel a little bit the movie of the match?
It was not the case, I have to say. It was really, 100% fair and everything. But we had some outside challenges in terms of weather, because we started the match and after having a score of 1-set-all, it was 5-7, 7-6, it came to 6-all and a tiebreaker in the 3rd set, which of course, you know, would be a decider going in one direction, 2 sets to 1 up. So quite a crucial tiebreaker. And then I got ready for the return and I saw that the umpire was rolled off the court sitting in his chair because it started to rain, you know, and they pulled on the cover over the court and I just escaped not to land under the cover. So escaped, you know, on top of the cover. And then we had some rest that day and we could not come back the same day. So I had to spend the night and I stayed at the Players Hotel back then at the Gloucester Hotel. And I remember another player was next to me. And obviously the same situation, you know, couldn't sleep. TV was loud and noisy and I couldn't sleep because I was so, you know, psyched about starting the tiebreaker, having to win the tiebreaker against Jimmy Connors. Obviously I have a chance. So next day I came back and I literally warmed up, in the rain for the match because I wanted to make sure that I come into the match from the first point already, you know, sweaty and being really ready.
Yeah.
And, I saw then Jimmy Connors coming onto the court. You know, not sweaty, obviously ready, but again, I thought maybe I have an edge here and I won a tiebreaker. So I took the 2-set to 1 lead. Then I had match points in the 4th. I was up 6-5.
Yeah.
Connors was serving 15-40. And I know he came up with a sly serve on the deuce court, you know, fading away from me. And I was so nervous, I just pushed the ball back. And then he came in onto my forehand. And I thought, you know, passing shot, cross court, a short cross court passing shot, you know, would be perfect. And then my arm didn't come forward because obviously I was so nervous, you know, I was like waiting for my arm to come forward and I missed that shot, you know, down the line. I lost the set because I was freaking nervous. And then it came to 3-all in the 5th. And I only remember the match point because I saw it on TV afterwards and I was in complete trance. And I think this literally was the reason why I managed to win the match in 5 sets. Because I stopped thinking because, you know, my thoughts played a trick on me and I was too nervous. I had no chance to really come back in the 4th. But literally, bottom line is it worked out fine. And I had to sit in the locker room right after that for an hour to really digest because I really had stomach pain. I was so nervous and, you know, it really was a big thing. Yeah.
Wow. Congrats about it. And we've done a big step forward right now, but you were telling us in the... when we recorded 2 days ago that your dream was Wimbledon, play on this big courts, main tournaments, biggest...
Especially center court. Especially center court. And if I may say so, this has worked out also fine because when I was young, I was 12, 13, I watched the Wimbledon finals, Borg, McEnroe on TV. And back then, this was the time when my dream started. I created this dream of being, you know, one day Yeah. I want to play on center court in Wimbledon. This was my childhood dream.
Yeah.
And then some years later, I can't recall exactly the year, it must be 91, 92. I literally played Ivan Lendl at Queens in a tournament prior to Wimbledon. And I won that match against Lendl. And then the draw came out for Wimbledon. And I was drawn against Ivan Lendl. And I thought, wow, I can play Ivan Lendl in Wimbledon. Maybe I have a chance there. And then I was scheduled on for center court.
Oh.
And then it all literally unfolded. You know, my whole childhood dream became reality. And I know every second I walked onto the center court, knowing that court only from TV.
Yeah.
And you walk a little bit up on center court. And the atmosphere was like, I felt like a little kid in the cookie store. You know, it was like unreal for me. And I lost the first set 1-6 in 20 minutes because I was so lost literally on center court because I was like, you know, looking around and my, you know, thinking and I can remember when I was getting ready for the serve, and I've not experienced this on any other court in the world. I got ready for the serve and, you know, you bounce the ball, you get ready, and this silent. I mean, there is no noise at all. It's just dead silent, you know? And it's like you see yourself from the outside, you know, you step outside of your body a little bit. You see yourself getting ready for really awkward situation, really a very strange situation. And I was, you know, I was not able in the first set to come really into the match because I was like,
yeah.
And then I get better after the first set. Eventually, I lost 6-7, 6-7, set 2 and 3. And then I knew, you know, the advantage the top guys had even more back then in the years when I played was they knew when they went to big court, to center court Wimbledon, to center court US Open, they had the experience of playing many matches there. And it was back then tough for some guys who came onto the court for the first time. And this was some edge the top guys had back then. But for me, it was like, you know, a dream come true, but kind of a special experience.
Thanks for sharing it with that kind of details. Really, I felt like I was on center court with you. I felt like I was a ball boy watching you serving.
Well, I have this emotions are still alive. They're so present, you know, within me because it was so intense. It's like amazing. I will never forget this, you know.
Wow. What was your sponsor back then providing the special type of shoes with the little, I don't know how to say, under the, you know, the feet?
Look, Max, I have so many funny stories. Back then, 88, when I played Connors, I had literally no contract, you know.
Okay.
And I think we talked about, did we talk about the situation where I played doubles with Boris Becker, 87, in Frankfurt?
No, yeah.
Boris had already won 2 Wimbledons, and I was literally just beginning, you know. And some friend of his asked me, you know, do you have a contract? And I said, no, I don't have any contract whatsoever. And I was, of course, playing, you know, some tennis stuff from a company. And he said, but you wear this. But yeah, I said, they give it to me, but I don't have an agreement. So he organized 2 big boxes of white clothing, just pure white, no label, nothing, you know, and took my records for 3 days, painted the records black, no logo on the string. And he told me, if you like, play with this. And when you hit the ball in the court, I call you and I might as well have a contract for you. And I was like, you know, I asked Boris, who is this guy? And Boris said, no, he's a very cool guy. Trust him. He is really a nice person and you can really trust him. So, you know, I went on, you know, and then 88, I played Connors,
yeah,
the match we spoke about. And I was all white, you know,
yeah.
No sponsor. And I remember in Germany, in the paper, the day after I beat Connors there, they titled like the white giant beat Connors at Wimbledon, you know, because I was tall and I was all white, you know, and it was very classy in Wimbledon where white is predominantly anyway, the outfit and everything. And then like 3-4 weeks later, I had a sponsor, you know, like took
nice.
two or three more weeks. But back then regarding the shoes, you know, I had no grass court shoes. And, you know, back then some managers or some supporters for players, you know, I knew a guy, he became a very close friend of mine. He sadly passed away a couple of years ago. His name was Stuart. He was a local. from London, and he had some Grasco shoes in the trunk, you know, in his car, you know. And I said, yeah, Stuart, I need some Grasco shoes. Do you have Grasco shoes? And he said, yeah, yeah, come on, have some Grasco shoes, you know. And I think back then, I think it was the Diadora Grasco shoe, whatever, or Reebok. I can't really remember. So you know, it gave me like two pairs of Grasco shoes. And I was like, yes, you know, I have Grasco shoes now. I can literally play on grass with Grasco shoes, you know. It was amazing. It was just amazing times back then, you know. Yeah. This is how things happened back then, you know.
That kind of story that would not happen anymore today, nowadays.
No, for sure not. No.
And you just said that you've been playing doubles with Boris Becker, who won twice Wimbledon already. How do you feel playing with such a legend, like being a... You were close friend, I guess, so that's why you guys choose each other. But weren't you too shaky on court with him?
I was quite nervous, I have to say. But, you know, on the other hand, I knew Boris well. We are, you know, we have had many practice sessions and we were good friends. So we played this tournament in Frankfurt and, you know, we always had the last match of the day. Boris did not play singles back then. We just focused on the doubles. So we were finishing always very late, sometimes after midnight. And of course, then by the time you go to bed to sleep, you know, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. And then we played the finals. And, you know, we were tired and everything. And the score was we played against Scott Davis and David Pate. And we were up 6-4, 5-4.
Yeah.
And I was serving for the match. And I got really, really nervous back then. And the score was 15-40.
Yeah.
2 break points. And, you know, usually you come together as a doubles and you say like, you know, server says, look, I'm serving wide, you know, cover outside or cover the middle or whatever tactics you're going to do. And then we came together and Boris said to me, 15-40, huh? Now you can show if you have a really good serve. You can show me how good you can serve, you know. And I was like, all right, you know, this is just what I need, you know. And, you know, I put up some good serves anyway, so I needed that confidence boost from Boris. We won the match then 6-4, 6-4. But, you know, that second, you know, and like the old story before, you know, it's unforgettable. You know, he comes to me and says, show me how good you can serve, you know.
And that was your game style, big serve, volley, aggressive. Yeah, that was your weapons.
Yes. I was never a patient player, I have to say.
Okay.
And I like the faster courts, low bounce. And of course, you know, my game, not in juniors. In juniors, I was playing everything from the baseline. But then I had a coach who really enforced me to go to the net, to be more at the net, to learn to be comfortable at the area of the net. And this is how I originally developed my surf and volley style. And I was always a player. And till today, you know, I want to win the point. And I want to make that point myself. And surf and volley was my game, yeah.
Nice. You've been playing on tour for 11 years, if I'm correct. And you've earned, in terms of prize money, $1,600,000 and something dollars. Was it enough to make a good living, to invest in your structure, to, I don't know, be safe somehow? Or was it tough for you economically speaking?
Back then as a player, you mean, or after my career?
Back then as a player and yeah, for the like early retirement.
Well, back then as a player, you know, once I had a certain ranking, I was up in the top 50. And of course, you know, we also won Davis Cup 3 times. The overall, I would say, economic situation while I was playing was fine, was very stable. You know, it was not like when I stopped playing that, you know, I was set for life. It was not that way, you know?
Yeah.
But regardless of that, you know, I will always, I'm a person, I like to be active. I like to do something. I like to do something I'm passionate about. And so speaking of today, you know, I'm so grateful that everything I do in terms of professional life for working and everything, it's related to tennis. You know, I'm tournament director here at the BMW Open. I work for Sky Germany. I'm engaged with Wilson for more than 20 years. I do clinics also in a holiday resort every now and then. And I do some speeches every now and then for companies. So everything literally circles around tennis, and tennis is still my, it's my life, it's my passion. So I will always do something, you know, and I will literally never stop working or doing something, even when I'm 70, 75, 80, because I like this active lifestyle. I like to be around young people, sportive, active people. I still myself like to be, you know, almost playing tennis every day and just to be, you know, feel alive and be passionate about what I'm doing. But after my career, I was always looking for new opportunities and also to grow as a person.
Nice. Wow. I wish I'm gonna be as active as you are. No, but great.
Let's play some tennis soon, and then you know we can share some passion. You know, maybe this is gonna happen one day.
Yeah, this is the key. I'll come visit you next year. Talking about the Davis Cup, how did you become a Davis Cup captain? You just said that you won it three times as a player, so it must be such an amazing thing for you. How, first of all, was it tough to retire from the circuit?
You know what? It was not tough to retire. It, because I had, unfortunately, I had a injury, a back injury, and I had to have surgery when I was 28, and I was out for like 7 months. And I tried to make a comeback. I came back, but I never came back as strong as before that injury I had. So I was kind of struggling to come back into the areas of a good ranking, you know, also in terms of economics and points and, you know, making the main draws. So I was literally one morning getting ready for practice, and I had no desire to practice. You know, I had just no fire in myself. And I skipped practice. I called my coach and said, oh, I'm not coming today. You know, maybe tomorrow, let's see how things work. And then this went on for some days, you know, and then I met with my coach and I explained the situation to him. And he said, look, call me when you're ready. It doesn't make sense, you know, to train when you're not on fire, when you're not really engaged and you don't feel it. And I didn't call him for like a couple of weeks, you know, and then he called me and then we met and that was it. You know, I felt it within myself. I really felt it that the time was up. And I was ready to go and leave the professional tennis life. Of course, I had some commitments, which I stood up for, and I played in the Bundesliga and everything. But that process started that particular morning, and it was fine.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever since, I never looked back and I regretted anything. I had a great time. I was very fortunate also with Davis Cup and the time I played. You know, it was all fine and I really had a great time. But I felt that it was a good time to leave.
Nice. Maybe just before telling us how you became a Davis Cup captain, can you tell us your best memory as a player, best Davis Cup memory as a player?
My best Davis Cup memory as a player. Wow.
Tough one, I know.
That's a tough one because there's so many good moments.
Is it so intense that it makes you teammates and way more than teammates, like friends?
Oh, look,
friends for life, that kind of experience?
For sure, friends for life. I can totally underline that. And the experience we had, you know, we were 88 and 89. We were like Boris, Charlie, Eric, myself, you know, it was just amazing, you know. But if you look back, you know, 88, we came together as a new team. We won the first match 5-0, second match 5-0, semifinals 5-0, and the finals in Sweden 3-0. So, you know, it was just like unbelievable. You know, we just like, we trained for like 10 days, you know, like crazy, 6 hours every day. We were like, you know, like together, like friends, and train and have fun and watch movies and make fun and train and whatever. And then we played, and I have to say, of course, with Boris on top back then, you knew literally by his Davis Cup record, which you can actually look up, you're 2-0 up if Boris is in great shape,
Yeah.
He wins his two singles, and then back then he also played doubles. And that gave us an amazing confidence boost, us other three players, And it was just, you cannot believe how intense that was, how positively intense that was. And those 2 years really, I mean, we were great friends before, but definitely made us friends for life. We still have a close connection. We're close friends, and we meet every now and then. We chat every now and then, and we have the same fun we had back then in the locker room still today.
Nice.
And then, kind of a new team. Came together in 93 with Michael Stich.
Yeah.
And 93 was actually for me personally the year I played every single match, doubles with Michael. And, I have a clean rest. We never lost any doubles. And especially for me, I would think my personal most amazing moment was the finals 93. We played in Düsseldorf against Australia. It was 1-1 after singles. A long Friday, because Michael played Stoltenberg. He was two sets all, 2-1 break down in the fifth. He turned it around. He won that match. And that back then, Mark-Kevin Göllner played Richard Fromberg. And he had 6 match points and lost the match. Both 5-set matches, very long matches. And Saturday, we were up against the Woodies, which were, number one for like a couple of years. And I literally played the match of my life in Davis Cup, and we beat the Woodies to be going 2-1 into the Sunday.
Yeah.
And then Michael went on the court and won his singles against Fromberg, and we won Davis Cup. So, I really had a very intense, active part in that Davis Cup, and it was amazing.
Weren't you too disappointed when the Davis Cup became the Davis Cup that we know today? Like the new version of it?
Oh yeah, big time. I think honestly, until somebody convinces me otherwise, I think honestly Davis Cup lost its soul by that move, because Davis Cup, if you look back in history, Davis Cup is home and away. I played as a player and as a coach. I played so many Davis Cups. I was challenged to be playing with my team, let's say in Argentina, with this amazing crowd in Argentina, where they have always a band in the crowd sitting and, music and celebrating their team. You're up against Russia in Moscow, and you have to, you're challenged by the court, by the balls they choose, by the players, by the atmosphere. And likewise, you play at home and you have France coming, let's say, to play in Germany, and you have to, do the best you can for your team. So these were this was Davis Cup soul, this is Davis Cup, and now it's very different, and I think it's sad, and I think it's not the same anymore.
Right. So how did you actually become the captain? Finally, we're into it.
Well, I was actually 5 years a coach for the younger players of the age of 18, for the transition age.
Okay.
After school and to the professional life. I was actually with my family, and I had some 5 or 6 missed calls on my phone, and I saw that the president of the federation called, and I thought, wow, 5 or 6 missed calls, I might as well call back, So I called back, and he said, look, I want to ask you, we would like to ask you if you could do the next Davis Cup for us, prior to that, Michael Stich was Davis Cup captain, but this didn't continue, and a match was coming up. A couple of weeks later, a relegation match in Germany. And I said, look, I'm going to do this, this one match, and we see how it works out. And we take it from there. But I'm ready for that one match, and let's do this. So we had that match, and the team was back then Tommy Haas, Nicolas Kiefer, Rainer Schüttler, David Prinosil. So a very strong team. We played Solid. Indoors against Venezuela back then, relegation match. We won that match. And, then I was asked if I want to continue. And I sat down with the players. I said, look, guys, I love that challenge. I like that challenge. For me, Davis Cup is literally, has made my life. It's just amazing what I have had the chance to experience. But I can only do this if you want me. because literally the players have to accept you. If the players say, look, we want somebody else, fine, you know, fair enough. But then I wouldn't be the right person. So the players agreed and they wanted me. And so everything started back then. And I, you know, it ended up being 10 years of Davis Cup captain and amazing moments as well as a coach.
Nice. Same question as the player one, your most intense memory as a captain?
Oh, many, Max. We need more time.
I guess. I wish.
To take it from the positive side, I really have to say that we played, you know, many relegations, but played one match in Germany against Croatia. I had Tommy Haas, back then Benny Becker, and Alexander Waske, Michael Kohlmann, who is Davis Cup captain now for Germany. We played Lubicic, Antic, and I think it was probably the most intense Davis Cup I had. Tommy won his singles against Antic on Friday. Benny Becker lost his singles Friday, 1-1. Michael Kohlmann got sick. He couldn't practice. He could practice only 1 hour on Wednesday and 1 hour on Thursday. That was it. But I still stuck to the doubles, and he played the match of his life. I mean, he played out of his mind, you know. And Alexander Waske, who was always amazing in Davis Cup in doubles, he just, you know, raised his level like tenfold, you know. And they literally beat Lubicic and Antic 2-1 up. And then I saw a match where I would say a captain cannot... I had the best seat in the house when Tommy played Lubicic, and I've not seen a more perfect match of a player in Davis Cup than the match Tommy played against Ivan Lubicic. He beat Lubicic in 3 sets. And I think also Ivan Lubicic was interviewed afterwards, and he said, look, I just had no chance. When Tommy was serving, the closest I got was to 30. Never had a break point, and it was just like a picture perfect match for Tommy Haas that day.
Yeah.
You know, a match you play maybe once a year or once every, you know, 2 or 3 years, everything just went perfect. Not one thing which was not perfect. And of course you won that match. And for me, being on the court and watching my player play such great tennis close to perfection was just unbelievable.
Wow. And the toughest moment you had to face within this?
Toughest moment was 2007. We had semifinals in Moscow against Russia, and 1-1 after singles on Friday. Then we had a doubles, Alexander Waske and Philipp Petschner, also a great Davis Cup player, played doubles against the Russian team. And Alexander Waske, he just pulled a muscle in his arm at the end of the, I think, 4th set or 5th set, and she just couldn't serve anymore, you know. And you know, Alexander Waske had a big serve. That was his best shot, you know, his big serve, apart from his confidence. And he just, you know, he didn't stop, but he just put the ball in the court, like, just, you know, push it back. They managed to win the match, 2-1. We took the lead 2-1 into the Sunday, and then Tommy Haas was up against Michael Yuzhny. And I thought, you know, back then on clay, Yuzhny is playing pretty flat, you know, so this might be a good matchup for Tommy, where he might have a chance, because against Igor Andreev back then, a lot of spin. Andreev played unbelievable Friday. Tommy had no chance. Andreev, too good. But I thought Sunday, maybe there's a chance. And I knew Tommy by his character, you know, these are the matches he lives for, you know. He performs his best, he's ready, he's, you know, taking it on. And he came to my room that morning at 7:30 with the doctor, and he said, look, I'm sick, you know, I was in the bathroom all night, I can't play. You know, and I was like, you know, I really had to sit down and digest.
Yeah.
And he was so sick, there was no chance he could play. And then I talked to Philipp Petschner, who played an amazing doubles on Saturday. I think back then he has not played a singles in Davis Cup, but, you know, he had to go on court and play singles on Sunday. And it was amazingly tough for him, because also by the mindset, you know, imagine you go for a 400-meter sprint final, you win that, and then, you know, your coach comes to you and says, look, the next day is 800 meters. You know, can you, yeah. It's tough to really, you know what I mean? It's
very tough.
Really tough. I mean, he tried his best, but then, you know, usually being so experienced and also with his home crowd, he was unstoppable. He took the opportunity for himself, played a great match, and then the Russian team beat us.
Yeah.
It literally would have been a finals in Germany against the US.
Wow.
And for me personally, this would have also closed a bit of my dream as a captain, my approach towards my players, to show them how great Davis Cup can be if you play at home.
Yeah.
A finals, huge crowd, all those emotions, the goosebumps, everything, you know, representing your country. But it was not meant to be, you know, and it was a tough loss. But on the other hand, now years later, that's also one story about Davis Cup, you know, and these are the stories Davis Cup creates, you know, in the good side, in the bad side, you have to digest losses, you have great wins, you celebrate wins together as a team, and you lose as a team. So it's, you know, it was kind of a, yeah, that was kind of a tough experience, but I honestly have so many good moments about Davis Cup. I'm a huge fan of I'm a kid of Davis Cup, you know, literally know me literally from Davis Cup. You know, I've never won an ATP World Series tournament.
Yeah.
I've made two finals in Adelaide and Moscow, but I played my best tennis for some reason always within a team, either it was Davis Cup or it was Team Cup or even Bundesliga. I always played my best tennis when I was with my friends, my buddies, and you know, representing the country or the club or whatever. You know, I love
you're a team player, and we have a common point, Patrick, is that Yuzhny beat us in 2002. The France, we were in Bercy final. Paul-Henri Mathieu was leading, and
I remember that.
2 points away from the victory.
I remember.
I was 12. I was in the stadium, and I cried.
wasn't it Mikhail Yuzhny's first singles ever in Davis?
Exactly. Yeah.
It was. I mean. It was unbelievable. Yeah. I remember that because I looked it up and I said, this young kid has never played Davis Cup before. He was, you know, thrown into cold water, you know, like, unbelievable, you know.
Such an incredible...
Amazing performance.
Chef.
Yeah.
And in terms of management, what is the best lesson you've learned through this experience?
You mean through management, to managing the players?
Yeah, managing the players, the preparation, the coaching, the approach, the human approach, if you could synthesize.
Well, I think it's to be fair, as a coach, you know, me too, and I think the coaches always ask 100% commitment from the player, of course, but vice versa, you have to look in the mirror as a coach as well and say, you know, am I able to give my player also 100% of me, of my knowledge, of my guidance, of my experience, you know. And during my time as a Davis Cup coach, I was always looking for new inputs, for new insights on how to make them better players, but also better people, better person, you know. And it's about growth, you know, everything as a player and as a person, it's about growth and continuing. And regarding tennis on the court, I worked very clearly on focusing on the right things. Just to give you an example, you know, if you play tennis and you play a match and you play a good shot or whatever, the moment your eyes go outside and they wander, let's say your eyes wander in the stadium, you know, your mind is out. Your mind is also wandering. You're not on the court, you know, because wherever your eyes go, wherever your focus goes, your energy flows, you know, it's where your energy goes. So, and in the Davis Cup, when we played, and I worked with my players more when we played away because we had the home crowd of the other team also to address. I said to my guys, look, focus on the match. Once the ball is in play, it's only about the ball, you know. It literally doesn't matter where the ball comes from, you know, who your opponent is, literally, because every single time a ball comes across the net, that's your challenge, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, look, guys, between points, if you want to look somewhere, you always look to me, only look to me. And it was my job, and I was very aware of that I guide my players through my body language, through my emotions, and we have this link, you know, and I can really guide them. And for me, it was being aware and conscious that I'm, you know, have the right body language, the right approach, an open approach. And it has been working very well. And for me, that was always a continuous, but then again, new challenge, because you have new players to play, other teams to play. You play away, you play in South America, you play there. So you always have these challenges within the challenge itself. Mm. But I love that. I love that situation, being challenged and you know, giving my experience and my best to my guys for them to play better. Because literally, as a coach, you know, the player is on stage. The player has to perform. And for my opinion, every coach is a helper, is somebody who supports the player in being the best he can be or she can be.
It's very interesting because we've done a masterclass with a mental coach last week, and he was exactly telling us about how to focus on the ball. And what you've said with the mind going to the crowd, to the stadium, every single player can feel it, even the sure. The club players, everyone can feel it and can exactly visualize what you've just said. Very, thanks for sharing that. And
no problem.
As a player on tour, what was the best advice you think a coach ever gave you?
One of my coaches asked me when I was very young, asked me two questions. And I think those two questions are quite good ones. Quite good ones, thresholds. First one, what is your goal? And I mean, really, what is your goal? You know, be precise. Be precise in terms of what ranking, for instance, at what time. You know, you really have to be precise in defining a goal. If you tell me, Patrick, look, I want to lose some weight, you know, and I said, well, you know, how much will you lose? Said, oh, maybe 5 or 10 kilos. I don't know. It's not a clear goal, you know. A clear goal is if you tell me, look, on the 31st of December, you know, I have 75 kilos. Bam, that's a clear goal. So the first question is, what is your goal? And the second question is, what are you willing to do to get to your goal?
Wow.
With everything combined, you know, sacrifice, discipline, practice, everything, you know.
Wow.
And I think these also gave me a lot to think about.
Yeah.
You know, and I can tell you, when I was especially working with the younger players, you know, I sometimes sat down, I gave a paper to the younger players, you know, 17, 18 years old. I said, tonight you write down your goal and you write down what you're willing to do to get to your goal. You know,
it looks kind of easy once you're a tennis player, because it's very accurate to set a specific goal as a ranking, as a time to...
Sure.
Even though the process might be longer sometimes. And as a tournament director, how do you cope with that?
Well, when I'm at the tournament, for me, it's all about the players. It's about the partners we have. It's about the spectators. And it's about everybody involved in our tournament. And my goal every morning when I get up is to make sure that everybody has the best possible experience within our tournament. If it's the player, the person doing the courts, cleaning the courts, swiping the courts, it doesn't matter. I want everybody to go home that day and say, this was a great experience. I had a great day. And at the end, when the tournament is over, that, you know, everybody is happy and that, look, we've done a great job. We have done a great tournament here. And I can't wait to be back next year.
Hey, you're actually giving me a great experience also, Patrick. Thanks a lot for sharing. So let's go straight ahead. And how did you become the tournament director of the BMW Munich Open in Munich, sorry?
It literally happened 2007. And it's linked to kind of a very sad story. I have to say, because at that time I was Davis Cup captain, but we had a great tournament director at this tournament, Rudi Berger. I don't know if the name rings still with you. He was an umpire many years on the ATP tour, and then he took over the tournament director position at the BMW Open for many years. And I have to say, he's done an amazing job. He was a close friend of mine, and you know, because, you know, when he started umpiring, I started playing tennis, and you know, he sadly developed cancer, I have to say, back then. And it was really heartbreaking. I was receiving a call in 2007 from the person organizing the tournament, the agency behind all this, asking me if I could be backup for the tournament in 2007, just in case. And I said, look, 100% I'm in, you know, but let's not even go public or talk about it. I'm here if you need me, that's it. All fine, you know.
Yeah.
And lucky enough, you know, Rudy did the tournament and I didn't have to do anything back then. And sadly then Rudy passed away a couple of weeks after the tournament in 2007. And then we also waited, you know, a couple of weeks and months in order to take this on. And then literally, you know, Klaus, that was his name, Klaus Saron, he asked me if I would take over the tournament director position. And I said, look, I would be honored to do this. First of all, it's a great a tournament, has a long tradition of being played over 100 years. And also being in the footsteps of Rudy, you know, taking on his approach and developing the tournament further, also how he would have gone about, you know, his job as a tournament director. And literally, it was important for us to also integrate then a tournament for the younger players, for the under 21-year-olds. We invented the Rudy Berger Cup, which is always played within our tournament. And, you know, his name definitely lives on.
So you became director in 2008?
Yes, 2008.
How did the tournament leveled up from... So it's been 13 years already. And how did it become, like, I don't know, did it grow somehow? Did it get better?
Sure. Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. I mean,
how?
Look, we had some changes also in promoters and people we work with. And since 2013 or 14, we have a very experienced agency behind all this. They've done great sport events. Also, the biggest like in Australia, like a big events in Germany. You know, a lot of experience and really engaged. They are passionate about tennis. So that experience came in.
Yeah.
Then we had, a great leadership also from the club here. It's one of the leading tennis clubs in Germany. Great tradition. It's located on the English Garden. So it's a great atmosphere. And then we have, and this is probably also very extraordinary, we have long, long partnerships with our partners. Let's say our title sponsor, you know, BMW is in, I think, since 87. And, you know, we all together have taken this forward, you know, and it was always like our approach for me personally with my team to, as we're 250 category, to first of all, in recent years, be one of the best within that category, you know, to grow within the category,
yeah,
to make that experience for the players better, to make the experience for the spectators better, to make the experience for the partners better. And this was always our approach, niche by niche by niche, to create this uptrend or growth factor within what we have.
Many tennis legends went to play the tournament. As I told in the introduction, Tyriak, Stan Smith, Ash, Vilas, Lendl, Agassi, Federer.
Amazing, yeah.
You have one or two anecdotes, like nice stories about it to make us understand the history of the tournament?
Well, the history of the tournament is a long history. I can tell you that my Davis Cup captain back then, Nicky Pillage, was also prior to Rudy Berger, tournament director here. So we have a lot of tennis passion on site. Regarding those names we just talked about, of course, you know, huge legends. I can tell you, since I'm tournament director here, I'm happy that the German players have really played well in Munich. They had very, very good connection always with the crowd, with the spectators. We had like Philipp Kohlschreiber winning the tournament three times, Tommy Haas winning the tournament, Rainer Schüttler finals, Florian Mayer finals. And it has always been a nice challenge for me as a tournament director with my team to bring off the, and this is what we try to do. We try to bring young players, the upcoming next stars to our tournament, to really show our spectators and partners what is going on with the next generation as well. You know, you have this mix of of experienced players, and you have also the young players who come and play your tournament. So I would say for our experience at the, as a tournament itself, I think the atmosphere makes the difference. As we play in a club here, one of the nicest clubs in Germany, surrounded by nature, the spectators can, and the fans, especially kids, you know, they can be really close to the players. You are like right next to the practice court, 2 or 3 meters. You know, you see and feel every emotion of the player when you sit on center court, when you're on court number two. You know, you're really close, you're really engaged. And I think that's a big difference of tournaments like we play, and especially our tournament. And of course, we have the Bavarian German flair integrated into this international approach we have. So it's a great mix. And like I said, you know, our approach is to make every day a great experience for everybody.
Is the clay very similar to Roland Garros? The balls are the same, or what is the courts?
Yeah. The courts, what can I say? We have great courts. No, but I have to say that courts, because I know this, it's really, really important for a tournament. And we put this very high on our priority list, to have good courts. Because I know as a player myself, it's not really nice when you play on courts where you have a lot of bad bounces. And, you know, you're not really, when you want to play precise, you know. And I'm proud to say that we have great stuff doing our courts. And the courts are really nice, really good. And what was the other question? Sorry, I was...
The balls.
So much in the balls, yeah. the balls are the same balls as the tournament in Madrid, which is the next week following our tournament. I think Roland Garros has changed now to another brand. So we have different balls, but you know, it's important for us to have actually the same as the week prior, the week after our tournament.
Yeah. What is the brand of your balls?
We play Dunlop balls.
Okay.
All right. Dunlop ATP, yeah.
Yeah. What is the budget of the tournament?
This is a very interesting question, which I cannot even answer, because all the financials are covered by our agency. And of course, you know, I'm engaged, but the bottom line of the financials, you know, it's not on my plate.
Yeah.
Good or bad, but it's up to the guys in the back office there.
And do you know if it changed a lot this year because of COVID? If you've had the same sponsorship on the...
Well, we have... I couldn't even tell you, honestly. And you know, it's something, as I'm not engaged in the financials, I'm not somebody who... I'm not asking for this kind of stuff, because I know it's in good hands and we have experienced people there. But of course, it has an impact, as we have no spectators this year.
Yeah,
and also the ATP has approached also the prize money with the tournaments, you know, where the prize money is deducted for the tournaments, but the ATP levels up to a certain percentage,
yeah,
which I think is great. And also the prize money is spread a bit broader this year than in previous years.
Who are the best players coming over the year?
Oh, we have Alexander Zverev coming back. He's literally coming since 2014.
Wow.
Back then, when he was 16, we granted a wild card to him, and he's been coming back ever since. Then we have, and I'm really proud to say this, we have many players who played well this year already, who have won tournaments this year. You know, the ATP ranking is frozen, but the race ranking is what is has been important to me. And we have players like, you know, Yannick Sinner coming to Munich, Hubert Hurkacz, the two finalists of Miami. We have Casper Ruud and Daniel Evans, who played semifinals in Monte Carlo, coming to the tournament. We have Basilashvili, who won Doha. Fuxovich has been playing great this year. So we have some winners in our, you know, field.
Yeah.
The cut is original cut 71. Qualis cut originally is 92. So we're set for great tennis, for sure.
Do you have financial guarantees or any contract to make sure that Zverev, for instance, is coming every year?
Well, we have, the experience that players, you know, come to play in Munich. Because I don't want to go too deep into financials, but what I can say is that as a tournament itself, you know, as a tournament we create, we have so many players, once they came to Munich and once they have experienced our tournament, they literally like to come back. But it's one more thing I want to say. If you look from the scheduling point, the week after Munich is Madrid, and Madrid has an altitude of about 700 meters.
Yeah.
And I guess you play tennis as well, right?
I do, Patrick.
Yes. So of course, altitude has an impact, you know?
Ball flies.
And ball flies. And Munich has 500 meters altitude.
Okay.
So if you play that week, I think it's quite smart to play Munich and then play Madrid, because you have that transition, which is much easier. And a good example for that is probably Andy Murray coming to play our tournament in 15.
Yeah.
And he won that tournament on the Monday finals against Kohlschreiber and went on to win Madrid the week after. So, you know, it's quite beneficial.
Because otherwise it's Estoril and it's at the sea level, right?
Estoril, I guess, is sea level. And I'm sure the guys there do a great job, and it's also a great tournament.
Yeah.
But in terms of altitude and the transition you have, we have a bit of an edge here. Yeah.
Is there another tournament the same week?
On Estoril in Munich.
Okay. All right. After doing three episodes like that with Kojol, with Ronnie Leiteb in Marbella, Zeljko Franjulovic in Monte Carlo, they all more or less told us that the best synopsis for a tournament director is his top seed, number one, to win the tournament. Is it the same case with you? Or if your heart would talk, which player would you like the most to win this edition, 2021?
Well, you know, as playing a German tournament, and you have such a great player from Germany coming to play the tournament, Alexander Zverev, I've seen him win the tournament. Of course, I would be happy for him to win this tournament again, no doubt about that. Because he's our key player, our most featured player as well. But then again, you know, there have been surprises. And I think also Jannik Sinner is somebody who really has a big shot on winning the tournament. Also, Aslan Karatsev, I think, has a very good run this year, playing the semifinals in Melbourne and winning Dubai. So there's some spice in that week. But as a tournament director, I don't have a favorite, like as a favorite who I want to win. And I think I should not have that. I'm happy, you know, if everybody stays healthy, nobody gets injured, everybody can play their best tennis. And then we see what comes out at the end, you know, and we have this year also a nice car to win in addition to the prize money.
We'll see who drives
off, you know, off our side, you know.
So yeah, your main sponsor BMW, obviously. What model of car is it to win?
I really can't say, but I don't know if I really can't say, because this is going to be go public on our press conference on Friday.
Okay.
All right. In 2 days. But if you can broaden your view, you might as well get a sense of it somewhere in the background. I don't know.
And you think it makes quite a difference in terms of motivation for the players to come and play your tournament?
I hope so.
Know that there's a cool car to win?
I hope so, yes. I guess so. I think it's something very special, which we have as a tournament since many, many years. And it's a big tradition. And I hope so. It makes the players, you know, maybe give a little bit, 1% more, you know?
Yeah, that's it. That's what we're looking for. Is there speed limits in Germany? I don't know.
There is usually no general speed limit in Germany.
Yeah.
We have sections where the speed is limited.
Yeah.
But generally, we have no speed limit.
All right. Well, this is it. Is there end word you would like to conclude this very cool episode, Patrick?
Well, first of all, I want to say thanks to you for your time and patience, and for also giving me the platform to talk about my passion. So I really enjoyed that really a lot, and maybe, you know, there is some other time, some other day where we can continue. And what I can say is that, you know, I'm really looking forward for summer, for better weather. I'm saying this because I hope that, you know, everybody who is passionate about tennis will be able to go back to the courts and live their passion, play tennis, and you know, live that sport which we all love so much. And of course, we have this pandemic now, so being outside and having a chance to probably play outside would do us a lot of good, you know.
Yeah, and hopefully next year you'll have the crowd and it will become a bit more normal, sure, if we could say.
Sure.
Well, thanks.
You have to live up to the challenges. That's the best you can do, you know?
Yeah, nice.
You always have a choice.
Thanks a lot, Patrick. J'espère sincèrement que cet épisode t'a plu. Viens nous le dire en commentaire si c'est le cas, ça motive énormément à continuer. Pense à récupérer tes formations offertes en lien dans la description et à très vite pour un nouvel épisode. Prends soin de toi. Ciao.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.